Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our motto, Ex Tenebris, is Latin for out of the shadows. We attempt to understand the complex world around us and bring light to subjects hidden in darkness. We explore paranormal topics with guests from all around the world. Now welcome your Lost River Legends hosts, James and Brett. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our guest today is Troy McLaughlin, and in today's episode, we talk more about the Electric Universe. If you haven't already done so, please listen to episode 9 from season 2. In that episode, we lay the groundwork for the Electric Universe with Michael Armstrong, and we answer basic questions about what the Electric Universe is. In this episode of a two-part series, we spend a vast majority of our time on prehistory and discussing what Troy calls the primordial dawn, that followed a cataclysmic creation and allowed for the golden age of mankind to come about. We discussed the theory of the polar configuration of the planets and the impact Saturn was having on the Earth. Troy's access to recall biblical texts, interpretation of texts, and chronologies is astounding. The natural flow of our conversation allowed for us to discuss the Nephilim, who is Cain's wife, and more. Troy McLaughlin is the author of The Saturn Death Cult and The Purple Dawn of Creation. We want to thank Troy for being our guest on this two-part series and for sharing this information with us. We thank you, our listeners, for finding and listening to Lost River Legends, and we hope you enjoy the show.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, today we're joined by Troy McLaughlin. He is joining us from Cambridgeshire, UK, Britain. And we're so thankful to have him here, and he's taking time out of his relaxing Saturday to join us and speak on some of the implications of a Saturnian model and a primordial time when it comes to our Earth and some of its history and prehistory. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So looking into your work here, we've been really excited to see how it nests very carefully with the Electric Universe model and how it leans on that as understanding the relationship between heavenly bodies, and that we haven't always had a planar solar system with the arrangement of the planets the way we know it today and the way we learn it in school. Can you get into kind of rewinding us in time and giving us a little bit of an understanding of how things might have been?
Yeah, sure. So my book relies on what's called the Saturn theory model, which is a subset of the Electric Universe model. It's a radical reappraisal of the origins of our solar system, in which the sun is capturing various bodies from space, rather than the accretion disk sort of model of planetary formation that most people are familiar with. It's probably one of the more difficult aspects of the book to grasp, because the standard uniformitarian way of looking at the formation of the solar system is so ingrained in us that the idea that objects are captured by the solar system that are the size of planets and moons and so on seems to be very odd, and it's even more bizarre to most people to grasp the idea that this may have happened during human existence, during the period of time that man has spent on Earth. And so therefore, it's largely based on the mythological accounts and using the Electric Universe model to explain mythology, which is a very, very complex and chaotic, body of work from the various peoples of the Earth, is used to explain what they saw in the skies at the time they were forming mythology, and give a much better interpretation as to what influenced them in terms of their religions, in terms of their history, and basically what they effectively saw in the skies. They had very different skies to the ones that we see today. So I guess really in a nutshell, my book, Saturn Death Cult, uses Saturn theory to explain why there are effectively two golden ages that exist on Earth in terms of the corporate history of humanity as a whole. We have a mythological golden age that is shared in most mythologies, if not all mythologies around the world. This mythological golden age is way back before supposed recorded history. We have a time in that mythological golden age where the god Saturn is said to rule, and it's a peaceful, wonderful time. It's often known as a time of paradise. That comes to a disastrous end called Doomsday. And what we also have is the idea of a rebirthing of a new golden age. And there seems to be on the planet a move that a new golden age would be technologically driven by humankind and be ruled by those elites that have the ability to produce this kind of technology to create a new world and makes them effectively the inheritors and the custodians of the ancient mythological golden age ruled by Saturn. Now, the central conclusion to my book is that I link what happened back in the mythological golden age, which came to a disastrous end. I take the deep ingrained archetypes that scarred humanity as a result of those cataclysms that brought about the end of that age, and show how it's linked into a concerted effort, a kind of a hidden culture that has grown up throughout all cultures in the world, where people have used usury and ultimately the central banking model of debt-based finance to engineer a world population towards this new golden age, this new technologically driven golden age, where effectively they can get a free lunch off the backs of others while they plan this new world for themselves at the expense of the common person.
Yeah, that's the implications of that are very strongly tied to our everyday lives and what we're seeing. It's very interesting that you use the word elites, and I know that there's some implications there with the prefix of that L. It's interesting that you say they're trying to create a new world when we have someone named Elon Musk, spelled with an EL, trying to go to another planet and terraform it and turn it into something else.
Yes, very much. I think the whole idea that this planet itself will be rewilded, something that is heavily promoted by Cracky. We had a guy in the UK here die recently. You might have heard of him, Prince Philip. He was involved with the Bilderberger groups, the Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, these kinds of people. And, along with what I would call the financial elites, these people have really strongly worked towards a world in which humanity is subjected to the needs of the planet rather than the planet provides for the needs of humanity. And in terms of that, they have a view of the world being rewilded, where humanity is reduced to a state of servitude, in which basically nature takes precedence over humanity. So yes, their golden age is very much tied up in what we see today in terraforming of other planets, rewilding of this planet, and much of what we consider to be the conservation industry as we see it today.
Which is really interesting if you think about the inversion of that. You'll eat by the sweat of your brow. Well, now it's inverted and you're going to serve us and we'll give you your food to eat.
Yeah, you've hit on a key theme there, that this golden age in mythological times ends with a disaster. Before that, there's this idea of a paradise. You didn't have to struggle to get food, fish jumping into frying pans, all year round harvests, that sort of idea that you've got from the original Golden Age, it all comes to an end, and that brings about something that happens on the Earth as a result of that is that the Earth starts to experience seasons and subsequently scarcity of resources. And the monopolization of those resources becomes the struggle between what I call people of the Earth, those of us who are what some people would just call the common people, and those of the blood, those people who believe in a position through bloodlines and so on, in which they should have control over the scarce resources that we begin to suffer after the end of the Golden Age. And this is, by the sweat of their brow. They're not interested in by the sweat of their brow. Their job is, as far as they're concerned, by the sweat of our brow, they will eat well.
Exactly. I'd like to take things back and kind of look at the point of view of an early human on the planet, and what the Saturnian sky or pre-Saturnian sky might have looked like, how that evolved over time, and how those different capturing of planets might have related to different mythological symbols or figures. So I'd like to really get into that.
Yep. Okay. Well, the mythological aspect of this theory, all right, is what determines what we're looking for and why we're looking for explanations that are presented in what we call the electric universe model. And what we find is this madhouse of mythology describes a world that makes absolutely no sense to the modern human. I think for the listener, it's very important that they understand that a sky that we see today is not the sky of the ancients, and that the ancients worshipped, or going to say they recognized, that their first major sun was positioned at what we call the North Pole now, or the celestial north above Earth, which is one of the craziest things, if you look at the skies today, that you've ever heard, and gave a lot of comparative mythologists, academics of the 1800s up to the 1900s, a lot of heartburn, because it didn't match what we had with this idea of a sun rising and setting east to west. Mythology talked about this stationary sun that just stayed where the celestial north, where the pole star is today, roughly. It's, you've seen those time-lapse images of the celestial north where the stars swirl around a central spot. That's where the ancients believed the original sun of this planet existed. So modern academics, historians and so on, who believed in a thing called sun worship, could not understand that the sun that the ancients were worshipping was claimed to be at the north, in the celestial north, and that is why they oriented all their major temples towards the north. The Great Pyramid at Giza is a classic example. It is the most perfectly celestially north-oriented building on the planet, even to this day. Even the Greenwich Observatory in London is not as well pointed to celestial north as the pyramid. But most temples and so on were configured in this north to south, not east to west, configuration, which you would expect if they were worshipping a sun that rose from the east and set in, rose in the east, set in the west, and so on. So what happened was that there was this idea of sun worship, and it was linked to the North Pole, yet it didn't match the skies today. So John J. O'Neill and many of the academics of the late 1800s decided to contrive this idea that they were talking about the sun that we have today, and somehow all got confused in their minds. They placed it at the North Pole, yet what they were really talking about was the sun we see today. But an honest appraisal of mythology is they are not talking about that sun that we see today. They are talking about something that sat up in the celestial north. Now, I'm going to give a quote which I give in most of my radio, in most of my interviews, simply because it puts in the listener's mind what we're talking about in terms of mythology. And it's from a guy called Duardo Cardona, who was who's written five excellent volumes on Saturn and its position in the solar system. And his quote is that the evidence of myth, which points to Saturn having once occupied a position above Earth's north polar regions, is voluminous. There is not a race on Earth that has not preserved at least one account which states as much. According to this evidence, Saturn occupied a central position in the north celestial regions. It rotated and rotated widely, but other than that, it was immovable. So, for your reader's benefit, sun worship in the ancient mythologies of ancient Egypt, Greece, the Incas, the Aztecs, the Chinese, the more ancient old world civilizations, even the South Pacific islands, and particularly the Indus, the Hindus, but also in particular Babylon, these ancient civilizations. To them, the sun was Saturn, but to the modern world, the sun is this pinprick of light. Saturn, sorry. Is this pinprick of light at the outer realms of the solar system. So how did these guys confuse that pinprick of light for what they considered to be the life-giving sun under which they basked for an entire age they dubbed to be the greatest age, the golden age? Now, that's a question that to people who believe that the skies are as they have been for the last 4 billion years or so, give or take, there's always been this Earth rotating where it is, and the sun always rises in the east, sets in the west. For those that subscribe to that, mythology is completely bizarre. It's bonkers. It's nuts. It makes no sense. And so mythology is being reinterpreted where the reference to Saturn or the original sun has always been passed off, and they mean soul, the solar disk that we see today. And that's where a lot of the confusion stems from. The electric universe, however, provides a mechanism, a cosmological mechanism, to explain how the planet Saturn may have actually stood immobile, as far as observers from Earth are concerned, in the celestial north, and radiated like a grand sun, and did so for possibly millennia during human history. And this is where we go into, where we compare mythology with the electric universe models to come up with that solution. So when we want to talk about going back into that time, before doomsday, through the golden age, back to what we would call, what Hesiod referred to as the purple dawn of creation. He's the Roman poet who, where we get the term from. We have to apply a very, very radical cosmological reinterpretation of the formation of the solar system.
So we have to think in terms of perhaps a stacked sphere model. As the Earth rotated, it had in relation to it. Mm-hmm. Something directly above, which was emanating this purple atmosphere, mm-hmm. and kind of almost ionizing and precipitating,
sure.
that primordial soup.
Yeah. Yes, and so you've got two models here that mythology in describing Saturn sitting at the celestial north. There's only two models that work with that. There's phase lock. And and what we call a polar configuration. Phase lock is what the moon does with the Earth. If you stand on the face of the on the moon and look towards the on the side facing the Earth, and you look towards the Earth will never change. It's just always there from the perspective of the moon. So phase lock is the first model for this. The other model, of course, is the one that really gets a lot of people confused, and that is the polar configuration, where we have the Earth, Mars, and Venus at a later stage dangling below Saturn on like a string, below Saturn's south pole. We rotate in axial alignment with Saturn, as that configuration is maintained. And for many people, this is the most difficult thing in understanding how that used to be before there was a sun and so on. And this is why we have to go back into mythology, because mythology tells us that the Golden Age comes to an end when Saturn glowed wonderfully and it was beautiful and so on. But before Saturn glowed wonderfully, there was what Christians would understand as the "let there be light" moment in history. And before that, there is the biblical concept of the void, the darkness that existed with the Spirit of God hovering over the earth. Every culture has a variation of this. And this is not to be considered a darkness as in pitch black. It's like this eternal twilight. And what we find in the biblical account in particular is an anomaly. We get the "let there be light" moment, but the lights of the heavens are not revealed until the fourth day, if you remember the particular account from Genesis. It would seem bizarre in a situation where, if it was the sun we know today, that let and you know, the sun was the source of that "let there be light" moment. That's when the light, the moon, the stars, and everything would have been found. But what we find in the electric universe model is that this purple dawn, this time when humans, by the mythological account, lived in a world where you could not tell time. There was nothing to mark the passage of time. It was a dull, murky, savage world where an eternal glow, a purple glow, twilight existed planet-wide wherever you were. They all talk of this similar kind of scenario. Some describe it differently, but it all works down to the same idea. It's a dull, dusky world that humankind seems to have existed in for an indeterminate period of time before Saturn, or before God says, "let there be light," and light is introduced into the earth. Now, this time is best described in the electric universe model as what life would be like under a brown dwarf star. Now, that's the implications of Saturn theory to the electric universe model, that what mythology is telling us is that humanity began on a satellite of a brown dwarf star that was in tow to a brown dwarf star that eventually got captured by the sun and became, and that brown dwarf star became the planet Saturn, and Earth realigned itself within and began a life as a satellite of the sun proper, while the other planets involved with Saturn, Venus, Mars, Saturn itself, were rearranged likewise to become satellites of the sun. Prior to this, there is a system, a Saturnian system, that is Saturn and at least two major moons, Earth and Mars, drifting in space, and it is eventually captured by the sun. It provides the environment that we read about in mythology. And as a result of that capture, it fissions, it ejects a core, an inner piece of its core, which becomes the planet Venus. And over time, that entire system is broken up and rearranged into what we see today.
So, and just for clarification, when you say one of these planets fissured and ejected a core, which planet were you saying?
That would be Venus.
Venus gave birth.
Saturn gave birth to Venus.
Interesting.
Yeah. So to explain that, if you accept the idea that you've got this brown dwarf drifting through space independent, it's a, you know, they're all over the place, actually. There's NASA estimates there's at least 7,000 of these things between us and the next nearest main sequence star. But it's very difficult to detect in space optically. You have to go looking for them with infrared and radio telescopes and so on like that. But if one of these things is drifting in space and it has two moons or two planets of its own, and one of those planets is Earth, the other one is Mars, when that system comes into electrical contact with the sun, which is far more, in electrical terms, is far more positively charged, all right, you get basically a short circuiting of the Saturn system, the brown dwarf system. And as a result of that, what can happen is you can get what Wal Thornhill calls true planet birthing, which is that the core, the metal core of the brown dwarf star, under the stress of electrical short-circuiting, it fissions and it fractures. And what you've now got is you've got a small piece of core and you've got a large piece of core that are both positively charged. And you know what happens when a magnet, when you put the positive end against another positive end, it repels. So the smaller piece gets ejected because it's positively charged out of the core of the brown dwarf and into orbit around the brown dwarf. But it's fissioning, it's very hot, it's very very young, you know, so it's not fit for habitation or anything along those lines at that stage. This is what Saturn theory proposes, and what mythology tells us, that Venus is born of Saturn. Some people might say, hang on, Velikovsky, for instance, said Venus was born from Jupiter. No, he got that wrong, and he admitted that that was a wrong interpretation. We're pretty much all in agreement now that Venus is a product of Saturn in mythology, and this can be best described by what I'm describing, the birthing of a new planet by a fissioning core from Saturn under electrical stress that ends up in orbit around Saturn and joins the polar configuration between Earth, Mars, and Saturn. It settles between Mars and Saturn for a period of time and creates all kinds of effects, which we'll discuss when we come to possibly what life in the Golden Age is like. But that happens at the moment of the Let There Be Light moment, when the Creator God flares forth and creates an entirely different world for the inhabitants to what they were used to under the Purple Dawn conditions.
So that's very interesting, because you think about the eventual cause effect and how these different cataclysms start setting things in motion to eventually evolve into what we know today. So that's kind of a very long tail, very kind of drawn out process over the different ages and the different cataclysms that we know have been recorded. One of which being the flood. I'd like to get into that a little bit, and then we can go back to the golden age. So with the flood, I think you posit that some of the water molecules could have come from somewhere else.
Yes, and to clarify, I've got two different floods. So if you're talking about the Noah flood, this is a different part of the chronology that I postulate. There's also in mythology the flood that takes out Atlantis, the seas covering that famous city. To understand that, we've discussed what the approach of Saturn was to the sun in its primordial state, where it was a dull brown dwarf that encapsulated within its system Earth and Mars, and at this time it didn't glow brightly. It was the capturing or the brushing, the first electrical contact with the sun's heliosphere that exploded nova-like this brown dwarf star into a full-fledged sun that changed everything and kicked off the Golden Age, all right? Now, what happens when a brown dwarf novas? It ejects massive amounts of water. That's because brown dwarf stars are copious carriers of water. And That ejected water is what formed the rings around the brown dwarf star that we became known as the rings of Saturn, and became a crucial part to humans being able to then, by using the way the rings reflected with the sun's light, the way that they rotated around the planet Saturn, it became a means to tell time. And so it goes from the purple dawn of creation, when under a dormant brown dwarf, into a fissioning nova-like brown dwarf that flares up and shines brilliantly for what's called the Golden Age. All right, that Golden Age comes to an end in a term that mythology gives us called doomsday. Doomsday has become a major archetype on the human psyche, the corporate human psyche. We all have this sort of fear of doomsday coming. Doomsday is a destructive period, which is linked to the loss of Atlantis, the sinking of continents, this kind of thing, and huge, huge floods that wiped out the civilizations on the earth. In the biblical account, I equate this with the fall of Adam and Eve. That's the end of paradise. That's when humanity is thrust out into a world where scarcity becomes the norm. You know, that whole thing you mentioned earlier about having to make the earth yield its fruits with the sweat of your brow. So the destruction of the Saturnian system, by its capture by the sun, its final destruction, where all the planets go out of alignment with each other and start to realign with the sun, that destructive period is related to the fall of the Garden of Eden, the fall of Adam and Eve. It's related to Atlantis and so on. When you get to that time, it seems that during the initial flare at the beginning of the Golden Age, all this water is ejected out of Saturn. Some of it forms the rings, but there's a cloud of water that goes into space itself. And as a result of that, it drifts in space as ice particles. It would seem that on the final trajectory of capture, I think about 4,000 years later is roughly what I believe, could be up to 6,000 years later, the Saturnian system collides with this cloud of water particles that Saturn initially ejected out into space. And this provides the deluge that takes out Atlantis, brings to an end the Age of Paradise in the Bible, the Garden of Eden period, and various fall of paradise scenarios that world mythology gives to us. Much later, not really much later, we're talking only 1,000 years or so, and the debate is, when do you date the Noahic flood that the Bible talks about? I've got the traditional dates are 2300 BC to 2400 BC. Other people have dated it as far back as before 4,000 BC, an extra 1,000 years back, and so on like that. Irrespective of the dating, I tend to go with the traditional dating based on the generations of the antediluvian characters of the Bible. But at about that time, what mythology also tells us is that the now decrepit, defeated Saturn comes into conflict with another giant called Jupiter. And Jupiter, particularly in Greek mythology, is known as Zeus. And Zeus comes back and kills his father, and who's, you know, been in the business of eating his children and so on like that. And Zeus replaces Kronos and sets himself up, Kronos being Saturn, the Greek version of Saturn. He replaces Saturn, sets himself up as the dominant planet at that time. And that creates another flood, the flood of Noah. That's what my own research tells me, that flood of Noah took place during the celestial war between Jupiter and Saturn as the whole Saturnian system is breaking up after the doomsday event that saw Adam and Eve ejected from the Garden of Eden.
So, and we also have in scripture that water came up from the deep. So you have that the water coming up from the deep, but also from space, basically. So that's really interesting. Those two meeting together would cause quite the deluge. We actually spoke in a couple of episodes ago with Gary Wayne about some of those bloodlines, how they might have even been a parallel where, you know, the almost like a separate arc where some of the one of the bloodlines might have been surviving while Noah had his posterity on his ark, and then 100 years later you get Nimrod, you get Babylon, you get the Tower of Babel, which could be translated as Stargate, but as far as their push or their as far as what they were trying to achieve, maybe had to do with what was seen in the celestial sky above them.
If you like, I can give you my take on scripture with regard to the flood and where Noah was at the time, that sort of thing, if you're interested in that.
Yeah, I'm totally game to hearing a different angle on that, for sure.
Well, I agree that certain bloodlines did survive the flood. Whether it was on a separate ark is down to the idea that people interpret the scriptures as saying that the entire planet was covered by water, correct?
Yes.
That's mostly the view that a lot of people hold to. What I propose is that the flood of Noah was not global in the sense that the entire planet was covered. And the reason I have this is because the word earth is exactly the same word earth used when Cain was banished from the earth. Cain was not banished from the planet. He was banished from a particular land, and he was taken to the land of Nod. But they use the term earth there in exactly the same way as they do with the flood. So it's my understanding that the flood really was a punishment on the descendants of Adam, who had cohabited. Some people like to call them angels as such. But again, my interpretation is that the sons of God are the sons of Adam, because Jesus Christ was the Son of God and was also a son of Adam and David. And such that the sons of God were never given to angels. And so therefore, the sons of God are cohabiting with foreign women to that particular group of people that descended from Adam. This apparently brought about the judgment that led to the destruction of that particular group, hence the building of an ark. Now, as you pointed out, the waters came up from below. And in the year 2000, I did a trip out to Western China to a place called the Tarim Basin. And it was fascinating there because the Tarim Basin is one of the lowest. I think only the Dead Sea is lower below, has a lower level below sea level as far as dry places on the earth. The Tarim Basin shows all the signs of a massive collapse into artesian wells that would have forced up water from underneath. Now, the concept there is that they would place Noah in that region on that side of what you call the Hindu Kush Mountains, at that time building an ark. And we have lots of evidence there that there are non-Chinese cultures that have existed there since millennium and so on. You've got the what they euphemistically call the white mummies of Urumqi. I went to see them. Yes, they're blonde-haired people and so on like that. You have this sort of idea of a non-Chinese people that have existed before the Chinese arrived in that part of the world. Now, the big fly in the ointment is, how do you explain Mount Ararat in this scenario? How does a local flood in the Tarim Basin that doesn't quite cover all the mountains, except does cover the low-lying mountains before the major mountains, how does the ark end up on Ararat? Well, Mount Ararat is a misnomer. Ararat means the low-lying mountains. It doesn't mean that particular mountain in Turkey, which has only been called Ararat since the 700s because the Muslims decided that that was going to be their placing of Noah's Ark. Before that, it was always known as Mount Masif. And it only became Mount Ararat relatively in the last 1,300 years. So what you've got is you've got the settling of Noah's Ark into a region on the Tarim Basin, the rim of what you call the Tarim Basin. And you have, we know that the Chinese record the most massive flooding of the Yellow River at the time the Bible claims that this flood took place. They even talk about a yellow-haired man on a boat surviving this cataclysm that must have taken place. The Tarim Basin is now it's a fantastic desert. It's full of sand and so on. But even up to the time of Christ, it was a pretty green, lovely place. It hadn't become the desert at that time. So that's me taking into account that the flood of Noah, while it has archetypal connections to the original flood that brought about the end of the Golden Age and such, it is more than likely it is a flood peculiar to the line of people that descend from Adam down through Noah. And, you know, it has to be said, what was the reason for Noah's saving by God? What was Noah was a great guy. Noah was a righteous man. This was not the case. We are told that he was perfect in his generations, which is a meaningless term unless you read it in the original Hebrew as genos from the Greek. And that, in other words, he was the last male who was fully descended from Adam at that particular time. And that's what was saved. So this idea that other bloodlines got through this, yes, it was a worldwide calamity, flooding everywhere, all kinds of problems and such, but survivable by many other species and even possibly other humanoid species, you know, whatever interpretation you want to go about. That's my explanation for the Noah flood and why it is so plainly clear that the Bible tells us that the descendants of Cain got through past the flood, but they weren't on the ark. How do we explain that?
Yeah, you know, that's a really, for me, that's a really good understanding of what could have happened, because especially with the intermixing that you talked about with the children of Adam, and you know, there's this understanding out there that the angels came down and we have Nephilim and stuff, and I don't necessarily ascribe to that. I do feel like I have more of an understanding of your perspective, that they just, there's this, you know, don't mingle with these other people, don't intermarry, don't have families. And that's my understanding. And that's the perspective that I hold. One of the questions
whatever the moral question is there from a modern secular point of view, that's what the Bible is actually telling you, that there was this problem with these other people. Now, you see, this begs the question, was Adam the first man according to the Bible? All right, we've got a major problem with that. This is what I call Nicolaitan dogma, because the Bible is supposed to be a world book when in fact it starts off as the chronicles of a particular line of people, as far as I can work out. Now, what happens is that if you remember, Cain kills Abel. Very interesting event, because supposedly at this time, all you've got is you've got Adam and Eve on the, if you subscribe to the original concept, the original dogma of the church, you've got Adam and Eve, they have Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel. The next son, Seth, is not yet born at this time. Yet Cain fears for his life. And God says, don't worry, I will put a mark on you, which is not a physical mark. It's a bounty. And that bounty, I think, was, what, 70 of any of the relatives, of any man who would seek to kill Cain, should anybody take retribution for his killing of Abel. Who are these people that Cain is so scared of? All right. Not only that, but he goes off into the land of Nod, finds himself a wife, and builds a civilization. And I've seen a very, very good book that links that to the arrival of King Sargon of Akkad, the beginning of the Babylonian civilizations, as that being the original character Cain. The point is that who are these other people with Adam and Eve and Cain, the only people on the planet, Seth not yet born, and yet Cain is fearing these other people are going to take vengeance against him. And God says, don't worry about it. I will take 70 of them if they come after you. All right. So you've got people running around at that time. And these people are not part of the subsequent lineage that is traced down through Seth down to Noah and to Abraham, all the way down to David and to Jesus Christ and so on. That's the lineal narrative in terms of the generations that are there. So when you have a situation where Christians are trying to promulgate this idea that the sons of God were fallen angels who cohabitated with humans and produced what you would call giants, Nephilim, there is a major, major theological problem to that. And that is that the first law of the Bible very, very clearly states that kind begets after its own kind. Now, this is something that all the evolutionists, all the people who are anti-God, may have a major problem, but every breeder of horses, dogs, whatever husbandry professionals know. And that is that even if you can produce offspring by two separate species, they are infertile. All right? There is, like, for instance, a horse and a donkey can produce a mule. A mule is infertile. And to get mules, you've got to keep breeding horses and donkeys. All right? You can't get a male and a female mule and produce another mule. It just doesn't happen. That's the same through so many species. Lions and tigers, the same sort of thing. If you've got supposedly angels manifesting themselves in a form of human form, but are angels, and producing a hybrid species called a Nephilim, that Nephilim is going to, by God's own laws of the Bible, be produced, be produced sterile, okay? Yet the Nephilim seem to have been breeding perfectly happy, all right, all the way through to the time when King David is slaying a descendant because he's got the six fingers of these giants. Joshua went up against them. And so they're obviously able to breed, all right? But there has never, in modern science, ever been a creature, two creatures of a different species that you breed together, that you can produce offspring, that goes on to produce its own body of offspring with another hybrid of its kind. And that's what we're told that we have to expect that the Nephilim did. You know, supposedly if the sons of God are angels and the daughters of men are the descendants of Adam, then you've got these hybrids called Nephilim. How do they breed according to God's laws? It's more logical that in the same way that Cain was extremely worried about the men coming after him and killing him as a result of killing Abel, with Seth not yet born, that these women are the women folk of these men, so that the daughters of men are actually those women folk of those men that Cain was frightened of. The descendants of Adam, who would later on be called the sons of God, that's the whole narrative train of thought all the way down to Christ, that ye are the children of God. The sons of God are the descendants of Adam, cohabiting with the women of the men that Cain was initially very fearful of.
You know, I really, really appreciate you sharing that perspective, because that, again, that's the perspective that I understand. And it seems mm-hmm. it seems to be more of a true doctrine than the Nephilim angle. And I don't not ascribe to the Nephilim, but mm-hmm. angels coming down and having sex with human women and then having offspring, it just doesn't sit right with me. And the way that you explained it is the reason why it doesn't sit right with me.
Well, it breaks that first law, the exactly. very first law, kind begets after its own kind. And, you know, the Nephilim are still there after the flood. All right. So if you take that Genesis 11 tract, you know, in those days, the sons of God saw the daughters of men were fair and came into them. And we had giants then. In the Hebrew, there's a huge problem. There's no punctuation in the Hebrew. And it's meant to read as if the Nephilim are the results of these sons of God cohabiting with the women. And the problem with that is that when you look at it more closely in Hebrew, and I've got a little bit of Hebrew from my university days, and I've checked this up with the people and so on, you should really read the whole passage. And if I give it to you in this way, it makes more sense. In those days, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair and came into them and cohabitated with them. I'm paraphrasing because I haven't got the text right in front of me. There were also in those days giants. All right. We're talking about two separate issues here.
Yep.
All right. But because there is no punctuation, they ran the sentences into each other to make it sound like the giants are a result of the cohabiting. But if you read it the other way, then it makes perfect sense that the giants are their own species, their own six-fingered species. They breed because they're still around during the days of Joshua, but they weren't on the ark. And and we find them as late as King David. Some people say they're still around, in terms of lots of different theories and so on along those lines. But in terms of this ancient stuff, it just doesn't make sense from a created world. I believe that the kind beginning after its own kind is a fail-safe against what we're seeing today, this push towards a technological golden age where there's almost this desire to transhumanism coming into the idea that we can take this animal and that animal and this material and so on like that, inject it into humanity, get rid of humanity and create a new species. That doesn't even need to breed. This is the major issue of this new golden age that I write about in Saturn Death Cult. This the kind of thinking that comes. But these people are hard up against everything they have ever tried. They can't create viable hybrids. They've created the propaganda for it. You watch Star Trek, mm-hmm. Hybrids are having sex with each other and producing races all over the place, you know. James Kirk is, having dates with alien species left, right, and center, and we're supposed to believe that, you know, he could have left his progeny around, the galaxy. But they are hard up against us. They cannot produce a viable population of hybrids. They have to keep manufacturing them, and I think that's one of the great fail safes.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's a lot to take in, and I'm still kind of processing some of the information you shared. I do want to circle back really quick. I just have a super quick question going back to the flood. Now, in my very simple understanding of, I kind of take a lot of things at face value. I try to apply some logic to it and try to keep my feet grounded in a lot of ways. But as far as the polar ice caps, you know, we're constantly hearing about, humanity's fault and the blame game that goes on with the climate crisis and
right.
and the melting caps. What's your perspective of the ice caps? Was it because the Earth flooded and the pole temperature that there's water there that froze?
Sure.
Then we talk about how there's a focus on Antarctica and there's an inner Earth concept that's being thrown around. And I know we're kind of running a little bit low on our time, but I wanted to ask that question, what your perspective is on that.
Okay. So one of the big, what would you call contrarian views, against, Saturn theory is the polar caps provide us, the polar caps provide us with a ice core dating that goes back hundreds of thousands of years. So how could the polar caps have ever been warm in the time frames that we're talking about, in the last 12,000 years? This is one of the big criticisms that we field on this. There's a whole lot of problems that have to do with ice core dating that you can't really go into it and so on. I mean, they've got aircraft from the Second World War. They got buried in Greenland in the ice cap. They crashed there and they left them. When they went and dug them out, if you took the ice core above those aircraft, they should have been there for 30,000 years. If you take ice core dating, should have been there possibly even longer, depending on how you interpret ice cores. Ice core dating is like DNA. It was considered like that's the end of the story, the end of the debate, and so on. And we're finding out that there are so many problems. That put aside, one of the biggest issues with the polar caps is that when you do dig down, you come down to organic material when you get to the bottom of these mass ice sheets. When you're on Antarctica or in Greenland, you come down to organic material. The Arctic, Antarctica and Greenland, the Arctic Ocean is itself the most organically lush body of water on the planet, which makes no sense whatsoever in terms of it should have always been a winter wasteland. Where and the fact that it's, you only get through the Bering Straits and up through past Norway in the Atlantic or Greenland and Iceland and Newfoundland on the other side, those are the only sort of egresses into the Arctic Ocean. Yet it is absolutely full of biological matter. This makes no sense if it's always been an Arctic wasteland. So in Sandefco, what I propose, and really not what I propose, what Duarte Cardona has himself proposed, is that the water that we now see there, the conglomeration of the ice that you've got, was a natural result of the breakup of the Saturnian system, where vast amounts of water in those places existed in the form of precipitation and so on, for a period of time, but froze over very quickly and started a process of icing, or what you would call sintering. Have you ever seen electrical cables that get frozen with ice, telephone lines, that sort of stuff? That's because they're running an electrical current through those lines, and ice loves that. It just starts, it's called a sintering process. It creates these very hazardous tubes of ice that wrap around these cables. Well, if the Earth is in an electrical relationship with the Sun, you have this this current going through the North and South Poles. You're going to get sintering of ice where that current, the Sun's current, is actually going out in between. In through the South Pole, out through the North Pole. The water that was up there, Duarte Cardona says in his works that during the primordial Saturnian period, when Earth and Saturn were its own system before it's captured by the Sun, that the gravitational pull and the electrical activity between Earth's northern hemisphere, Earth's northern pole and Saturn's southern pole, created a mound of water. A static mound of water that existed at the North Pole, and that this mound of water, when Saturn fissioned, this relationship was disturbed. The mound of water was released. It created a massive tsunami, introducing water to the to the coastlands of Alaska, Canada, Russia, Northern Europe. And this is what happened to the mammoths. This is what happened to a lot of the species. They got washed out in a giant tsunami washback. That quickly froze over and began the process of ice sintering, that resulted in the polar caps that you see that have been maintained now that Saturn is no longer in the position, well, once it broke away, from that position. And again, this also links into my theories about the Ice Age, which is, again, another topic that has to do with Earth during its primordial phase under a brown dwarf, how that existed. But that's, in a nutshell, how the polar caps were created. Saturn lost its physical link. The electrical link created ice sintering, forming the polar caps at those regions. and the loss of Saturn propelled Earth into its equatorial warmed phase as it is now, and subsequently that's where you get ice caps forming as a result of that. And as far as the very bad science of climate change, where you know, anybody's put an ice cube into some water and then watched it melt can tell you that it doesn't raise the levels of the water. It's just one of those things that they kind of miss. And even the glaciers and the ice caps in Antarctica, if they all melted in and such, not necessarily going to raise the water levels to the extent that they have. However, it's all attributed to man-made global warming. So the question is, why is Mars warming? Why is Saturn getting hotter, Jupiter getting hotter? Why are the moons getting hotter? Why is right out at the end, Uranus and Neptune, why are they warming? They're all warming because of their relationship. And in the electric universe, it's the electrical relationship to the sun. We are undergoing a solar minimum at the moment, but people do not understand in the mainstream sciences the electrical nature of how this works. I would say that we're actually more in danger of going into a cooling period than we are going into a warming period, and that it's all electrically based, so it's nothing to do with humanity. How can I say? When Mount St. Helens blew up, it produced, I think they said, something like 4 times the amount of carbon emissions into the atmosphere than the entire Industrial Revolution up to that point. Now, that's not the biggest explosion. We've had Krakatoa. We've had all kinds of other ones that are going off. We've got those volcanoes, you know, under the sea in Antarctica going off. It's more likely that that in combination with the sun is responsible and not humans for what we call global warming. It certainly isn't us driving SUVs on Mars that's contributing to warming up on that planet.
I appreciate that viewpoint. And I think that's something that's been leveraged and kind of thrown in our faces, but by like what you said, kind of almost the elite cabal,
yeah,
and how they're leveraging that on humanity. So yeah, we did talk
follow about the money.
Yeah.
Follow the money, James. It's, if I told you 20 years ago, they'll tax us for the air we breathe, everybody would have laughed.
Yep.
Yeah. Here we are. They're going to tax us for it. It's all a money game for these guys.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We just got to give Al Gore, like, I think he asked for $17 trillion and he'd fix the problem. Now trillions are being thrown around like nothing with various stimulus packages and things like that. But I won't devolve into that too much here. I did want to get into, we talked a little bit about different gravity effects. There's something called the Pacific Bulge, and there's implications there that the polar orientation might have been slightly different. I kind of wanted to get into that, and if that has anything to do with some of the symbols in the ancient sky.
The Pacific Bulge, not so much, because what you're talking about in the book that I've written is the Pacific Bulge is evidence that the Earth was once in phase lock orbit with a brown dwarf that became the planet Saturn, and that the Pacific Bulge and its Atlantic Bulge, if you've got what we call the North Pole pointing at Saturn, the way the moon points at Earth, and such, then the bulge that that you've got in the Pacific side becomes the what you would call celestial north of the planet, the celestial north point of the planet, what basically happens as a result of that is that even though it's orbiting equatorial around Saturn in this very, very ancient time, going back past the dinosaurs, that, you know, these particular epochs of time and so on, well past 100,000 years, back into time. This phase lock system, you get a bulge like that because there is still a north-south magnetic pull in terms of the galactic current. again, electric universe models show how this works. So that's where the bulge comes from in terms of the galactic current, not the Earth and the Saturn current at that time. There would have been a Birkeland current, as it's called, after the founder, that between Saturn and the Earth, that would have contributed to this. However, when Saturn electrically starts to sense that there's something big above its own north, which is the Sun, and its heliosphere, it starts to accelerate up towards that towards the main sequence star, the Sun. And as a result of that, effectively, it's what Walt Thornhill calls it starts to comet. And any satellites get dragged into the wake of the comet. They maintain a rotation until they get caught up in Saturn's own Birkeland current in its southern pole. And once it's caught up in there, it starts to rotate in axial alignment. And what we know today as the North Pole is still facing, but now rather than facing the equator of Saturn, it's slipped under and it's now facing, pointing up at the southern pole of Saturn at this particular time. They start to accelerate towards the Sun in that configuration. Mars is also dragged in underneath. And this is what we see. Now, the only sign in the heavens at that point in time is this dull disk that glows. To a human person who's experienced this, nothing's changed. Saturn is still seen as, you're standing pointing at Saturn. As you go underneath it, you maintain the same viewpoint of Saturn from an Earth perspective. You're now just in rotational alignment underneath it. The plasma sphere around these bodies doesn't allow you to see stars and the shift of what's taking in, so there's no perception. So this becomes a dull disk, and this is Saturn in his sleeping form. If you go into mythology, they talk about Saturn in his dormant sleeping form, particularly Mesoamerican mythology is very clear on this. And, you know, they call him Raven. At this, that's their word for him at this time. And he was a sleeping, raven who suddenly bursts into light and becomes Quetzalcoatl and all this sort of stuff. But that's about the only symbol you get at that time when these configurations were the norm.
So there's a certain point where the Birkeland currents and the Z pinch start giving us different symbols in the sky. One of those being a squatting man, one becoming a ladder or stairway to the god, to the heaven. Can you talk about kind of how that comes into play?
Well, plasma is the primary substance in the universe. All right. It makes up that 95% of hidden dark matter or black holes that mainstream science keeps looking for and trying to explain why gravity models don't work without it. That's actually taken up by plasma. Plasma has three modes. It has a arc mode, it has a glow mode, and it has a dark mode. When it's in dark mode, you don't see it. When it's in glow mode, an example of that would be the Northern Lights. The aurora phenomena that you see. When it goes into arc mode, you don't want to be near it. That's when it's, thunderbolts, lightning bolts are around and so on. When you've got two celestial bodies, two planets, either a brown dwarf star and a body like the size of the Earth, a terrestrial body, they form an electrical current between them, which is the current is facilitated by plasma. And it forms literally into a circuit. It's like a wire that connects both bodies between it. When the electrical field of the dominant body, in this case the brown dwarf, is changed in any way by outside influences, brushing up against another body, the electric field of another body, it could be the sun, it could be another brown dwarf, could be whatever, it changes radically and it sparks the... it sparks that plasma cable between these two, this Birkeland current between these two bodies. It puts it into glow mode when it's approaching. When it short circuits, it goes into massive issues, arcing electrical issues and so on like that. Now, in glow mode is where we often get the plasma scientists have seen plasma work this way in laboratories. When another object is approaching and it starts to activate a Birkeland current into glow mode, it can take on various configurations, particularly when seen below. In other words, if you're looking up through the length of the electrical connection rather than from the side. And those configurations can produce what we call a squatter man image. This has all been shown in laboratories at a scalable size. We're talking planetary size. And this glow mode stuff is what really triggered most of the images that we see in mythology. The squatter man image, probably the most famous one, is the eight-pointed star of Venus. Also the seashell, if you're slightly off-center, Venus is associated with a scallop shell sort of a look. That's where you would get the four current lines that you see sort of fan out into the scallop-like effect and so on like that. So yeah, mythology is absolutely full of plasma glow mode effects that would have happened if you were on Earth looking at a Birkeland current connecting Earth to Saturn.
So something.
Oh, you are going to ask about gravity.
Oh yeah.
Electric universe is also one of the key things. Is it's not mass that affects gravity as is believed by most people, because the world is dominated by this gravity only sort of thing, understanding of the universe. The electric universe postulates that gravity is an electrostatic phenomenon, and when the electrostatic environment has changed, gravity changes. So if you disturb an electrical connection between Saturn and Earth, you're going to change the gravity on both those planets. And it seems that through our history, our gravity has got heavier and heavier and heavier. And each time it gets heavier in a cataclysmic way, we get extinction events with these giant creatures that each epoch gets smaller and smaller. Yeah.
So that kind of lends credence to having longer lifespans, maybe bigger people in general earlier on.
I hadn't thought of that, but yes, that would be true. Yeah.
Different bone densities, things like that. Talk about dinosaurs existing, on the gravity that we have now, that their own weight would crush their own bones. So something would have had to been different environmentally for that to
absolutely
be the case.
And they're so dishonest about it, James. They're because they will tell you about the great big snake. I forget what it was called. It's like a giant anaconda that's, its vertebrae wouldn't fit through a door where you can hold an anaconda's vertebrae in your hand. This is how giant this thing is. And they're fully au fait with the idea that this thing had to live in water to buoy itself, because we've never had a creature bigger than the blue whale, which is still with us, but it's in water, so it can buoy itself. But we've got all these other creatures that are bigger than the snake, almost, rivaling blue whales in size and so on like that, but we know they're walking around on land. How in the hell did they pump the blood to their heads? How did all these factors in the gravity we have today? My co-author in the book Cosmos and Collision, he's the big one for gravity and the impossible dinosaurs. And it's his assertion that gravity during the time of the famous dinosaurs would have been one third of what we have today.
Yeah, see, and that seems to make, it just seems to click and make more sense with me logically. I really appreciate all these viewpoints. We didn't even have a chance really to touch too much on the Saturn death cult. I think we might have to ask you back for a part two, because we've kind of laid a really good groundwork, but we'd like to go through the ages and get into kind of some of that modern money system, how that has impact, sure. How there's implications in some of the sacrificial type things, and not turning a blind eye to that throughout history and also in modern times. So we definitely are going to have to ask you back and close the loop, so to speak, on that subject, because we don't want to go without it. It's part of the puzzle.
I'd love to come back. It'd be great.
We really appreciate that. We've got a little bit of a hard stop here, but thanks so much for all of your time and insight. You're doing such a good job stitching together these different subjects and helping us understand. Like we like to say, it helps us improve our lens to understand the curiosity that we have in the world around us and the history and things to come. So we really appreciate that from you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost River Legends. If you enjoyed this episode and you would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and consider subscribing. Here at Lost River Legends, our primary focus is delivering unique topics, amazing guests, all paired with top-notch production value. The Earth we live on has many hidden secrets, countless paranormal stories, and is filled with amazing, curious humans who are trying to find answers to life's questions. Here at Lost River Legends, we are no different. We believe an active curiosity to the unknown is ingrained in the human experience. We hope you will join us on our journey to explore the lost legends of the Earth by listening to past and future episodes. Until then, James and I wish you health, happiness, and a curious mind. And remember, the clock of life is ticking away. Don't waste another moment and live your best life.